Thanks so much for being a part of this today, guys. This is part two of our series on mental health and well-being. And last week, just by way of a little recap, we talked about how God cares about all parts of our lives, all the time, all parts. So like how the weather changes in all different types of weather, we think and we feel differently at times in life, and that's okay. Mental health is about our thoughts and feelings, our emotions, and like how everybody has physical health, everybody has mental health. Okay, so that's some of the, you know, just broad brushstrokes. But it'd be really neat to hear a bit from you guys about yourselves, about your history, your work history, that leads you to have a real interest in the topic of mental health and well-being. So who would like to kick us off? Laura, do you want to kick us off?
Sure.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm Laura, if any of you don't know me. I've been interested in sort of ideas about mental health and well-being for a long time. Starting with, there are some there's some mental illness in my family, so I kind of grew up sort of seeing different ideas of it. I have been a youth worker, so I've done youth work in churches and also helped run a girls' home for teenage girls, and there was a lot of stuff in there that got me thinking and wondering. I went through my own sort of journey with mental illness in my early 20s. I suffered from pretty significant depression for a year or so I've had a quite personal journey myself, and I've also been a mental health nurse back in Wellington for a few years. So I've got, I wouldn't necessarily say I'm an expert, but I've had a lot of different sort of experiences and seen mental health and mental illness from kind of different viewpoints. Yeah, that's me.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, and so I started out in 2011. I became a volunteer at Lifeline Aotearoa. And how I came to be in that space was that I'd come back and I wanted to study psychology. And a friend was like, well, I think you need to get some experience to kind of get into clinical psychology. So went along there and ended up becoming a part of Lifeline Aotearoa. And then did a couple of counselling papers and found that, for me, counselling was a much better fit than psychology. And psychology definitely has its place, so does psychiatry. But just for me, counselling just seemed to fit a bit better for me. And so I ended up starting a course at University of Auckland, and as part of that course I interned in a high school and a tertiary education setting, and also I did a bit of work at Lifeline Aotearoa with face-to-face clients. And upon graduating, I found that for me tertiary education was a place I wanted to continue working in. And so I've been working with the University of Auckland for about 3 years, and hope to do so for a couple more years, I think. And I kind of see there might be some changes on the horizons in terms of the clients I'm working with, but not thinking too far ahead. And in terms of my own experience of mental health challenges, I experience quite a lot of anxiety, especially in situations like this, hence the being in the middle, but I'm absolutely fine. If I run out screaming, you know what's happening, but I'm not going to. Yes, so I've got a real empathy for those people that that experience those challenges. And I think in terms of the Winnie the Pooh characters I identify most with, probably like I'm a bit of an Eeyore sometimes, a bit of a warrior like Piglet, and then a bit simple-minded like Pooh sometimes, but I'm happy and okay to be those.
Yeah, I sort of quite identify with Pooh in that I really want to help, but sometimes I've just got no idea how. Yeah, but I don't throw stones at people too often, or big rocks. I don't, yeah. Anyway, hey, so it was a really interesting story read out earlier. Thank you, Gary, for that. Have you guys got any further comments about that, or things that you, you know, would like to see highlighted out of that story that you think would be particularly helpful for us?
I think for me is like for me taking a really curious approach to why Eeyore is in the water. As we're going through the story, I was like wondering how come Eeyore is in the water. Was it by accident they'd gotten there? He wanted to go swimming. And, yeah, I think quite often when people are in interesting situations, like they may be distressed or they may be facing a challenge, is that our initial response may be to try and get in there and try and fix it. But I think sometimes just taking a step back and being curious about the situation someone is in and really, I guess, like validating their own strengths and abilities. I mean, Eeyore's got into the water. I wonder if they'd asked Eeyore how he might have gotten out of the water. Might have been a helpful way to, yeah, if he wanted to get out at all.
Mm. Yeah, what he said.
Yeah, cool. How does your faith impact how you view and respond to mental health and well-being? How does your faith?
I think we had been sent some questions to prepare, but I've been really busy this week, so I haven't. Okay, my faith impacts on my ideas of mental health in a lot of ways. Firstly, because I think Jesus' heart is always towards those who are suffering. Jesus' heart's always to those who might feel like they're on the outside, or who might feel like they don't belong, or they feel like they're not succeeding. Often when people are in mental distress or they're struggling with what's going on in their minds, I know from personal experience, it's easy to feel like you don't fit in, you're not winning in life, you're not managing. When I was really depressed, I wasn't able to hold down a job, I wasn't doing basic life things like sleeping well or managing to eat properly, or I'd drive to the supermarket and then if I couldn't find a car park right away, I'd feel so anxious I'd have to just go back home. So it's easy to, when things aren't good in your mind, I think it's easy to feel like you're a real failure or you don't belong. So for me, one of the most important aspects of faith is that Jesus' heart is always turned towards people like that. And Jesus' message is always that you are loved, that you are valued, that, that you belong. And I think that's probably the most important thing I've learned.
Thanks. I think for me at the moment, my faith is really helps me every week just responding to everything I'm seeing. And I always pray that when I'm with clients or just meeting people that despite all my imperfections that God's face will shine out through and be able to touch whoever I'm working with. And coming here every week, it's just a moment for me to be able to ground myself. I think I, as a child, or maybe, I don't know when this belief stopped, but I thought that I would just pray and then the anxiety would go and that it would be all fixed. But for me, I find it's a coming every week to church, it's singing, it's all my different practices throughout the week, connecting with God, that really ground me in those moments I'm feeling distressed or anxious about a certain situation.
Yeah, thank you. And we're going to come back to that a little bit later, aren't we? Yeah, thank you. So I don't know if you've seen the TV program Mythbusters. Mythbusters? You guys seen that? Is that a TV program? What is that? I'm not making that up, am I?
No,
you're not. Yeah, sweet. So in that, there's often like a little bit of truth with a whole lot of baloney, falseness, you know, not true. And there's quite a few, you know, myths around mental health and well-being as well. So I'm going to just put some of these out there and just see, you know, if you guys want to, you know, respond to some of these. So here we go, in no particular order. There are people worse off than you, or people worse off than me. So therefore, you know, things should be all right. How would you, you know, any responses to little comments like that? Or should I name them all? Would you like me to go through them all?
One at a time's good.
One at a time? Okay. Yeah.
I can remember, yeah, it's like that belief that if I can think of someone who's got a worse situation than me, I shouldn't feel so bad, is maybe where that comes from. And I think it's important that we all have our own experiences and all our experiences are valid, that just because someone has different circumstances than us doesn't mean I should be happy because someone else has got it harder than I do. So I think just for me it centres around validation and that everyone's experience is valid.
I think any point in life, that there's always someone who's got it worse off than you and there's always someone who's got it better off than you. And if we use that sentence on someone else, it's sort of like a judgment. And I just think, apart from anything else, judging other people's just not very helpful. Hmm. Yeah, especially if we haven't understood their story.
Yeah. So here's another one. if you just did the things that were helpful for you, things that, you know you should do, eat healthy, exercise, hang out with friends, get some decent sleep, why can't you just do that and sort yourself out?
I can answer that one. Sometimes it's not those things. From someone who's well, those things seem easy. But for someone who's not well, those things can be monumentally hard. If you think about, say, someone who has asthma. Does everyone know what asthma is? So someone who has asthma, your airway's narrow physically, so it's much harder to get oxygen in and out of your body. So sometimes telling someone who might be really anxious or depressed just to get over it and go out and hang out with your friends and you'll be fine is sort of like telling someone with asthma to run up a really steep hill without their inhaler. It's kind of like they might want to, every part of them might want to do it, but it's really, really difficult. And you might not understand if you've never had asthma. Yeah.
I really like what you said, Laura. I've got nothing to add.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that nails it, eh? Here's a common one. Harden up.
Your turn.
Is it because I'm a male?
No.
Harden up is that kind of be strong. I feel like it's a real Kiwi-ism, especially for men, around being strong. And I think it actually takes quite a lot of strength to be vulnerable. And I think it's really important sometimes that we are vulnerable so we can get the support we need. Because if we're always strong, if I'm always independent, when I do need some support, it's that much more difficult to actually reach out for that support.
I had a friend who had postnatal depression. So that's something that happens after you have a baby. Sometimes the hormones in your body can cause weird stuff in your brain. So she was having a really hard time. And it took her huge amounts of effort to do little things we take for granted. So if she managed to get dressed, like, she always looked after her baby fine, but if she managed to get herself dressed and out of the house, that was, like, really amazing. So that was her version of already hardening up, was I got dressed and I got out of the house today. And for her, that was a huge win. So usually a harden up comment is from someone who doesn't understand the situation, I would imagine.
I think of being from that really amazing place up north, childhood hero John Kerwin, and I think, like, All Black legend, real tough, hard man sort of thing of rugby. And if he has, like, a panic attack on the field in an All Blacks game, which he's had, not being able to, freaking out about catching the ball and knowing where to stand and stuff like this, then I think actually, yeah, it's a really unhelpful thing to say to people, because this actually affects everybody. It affects those who are considered in the Kiwi sort of culture, society, as the hard people. It affects them as well. It affects everyone. Okay, and here we go, another one, last one of the Mythbusters. I shouldn't need, or I don't want to use, medication. I don't need to talk to my GP.
I have to say that I'm really open to all forms of support, that if people find what's going to work for them, it can be helpful. I'm going to share a small story, and I'm not going to use any identifying features of this person, so I'm not going to breach their confidentiality. But I can remember when I was starting out as an intern, I saw this one client, and it was a struggle then coming to see me, and I just knew what we were doing together was not helpful. And so they went to see the doctor, and then I saw this person 6 months later at the reception, and they were just like a completely changed person. And so I have seen people who have gone on it, that it's really benefited them. But, yeah, I always just talk about being really well-informed. Like, if your doctor does want to prescribe you something, asking them, okay, what are the side effects of this going to be? Like, how are we going to make sure that I'm safe while I go on it? So I'm really, really open to whatever support is going to work for a client and make their life a bit better.
I think for me, I've seen medication not work well, and I've seen medication work amazingly. I think in this day when we have science tells us heaps about things we didn't used to know about, sometimes medication can be a real gift, like Panadol, for example. I don't know, some of you might not like taking pain relief at all, but I'm a real fan of, I have a headache and I can't get rid of it by drinking water, I'll take some Panadol and that'll help. I think when medication's not good is when people feel forced or obliged to take it, when they think they've got other ideas on how they can help themselves. One of the other slightly tricky things about medication is, like, especially with antidepressants, so stuff to take if you're depressed, is when doctors aren't usually sure which one to, there are a few different ones that work in different ways, and sometimes you have to be put on a few to get to the one that really works for you, and the process of trying them can be quite stressful. Yeah, but I think it's good not to be kind of afraid of the idea of medication, because medicines can do wonderful things for lots of reasons. Probably my advice would be the same as David's, like, you know, do some research, ask questions, and decide if it's something you want.
I think one of the beauties of medication, like particularly like in a for anxiety and depression and stuff, would be around bringing that support to be able to give the maybe the ability. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but more ability. To be able to process things and think things through and work on self and that. So that's been part of my story probably about 15 years ago. I had a little bit of a stint there where I just needed to get some help to be able to work through some stuff, and that enabled that. So yeah.
And the research that they've done on looking at the efficacy of pharmaceuticals and therapy, the best results they've got is when it's therapy in combination with medication that's brought about, like, the most effective results for people suffering from mental health challenges.
Cool. Hey, so there were some questions in the box, and so thank you so much for people who contributed. There's quite a few. It was really good. So we're going to just fire through a couple of these. Is that all right?
Yeah, go for it.
It's going to be fun.
You're going to give me the good one, the curly one?
Yeah, sure. Okay, here we go. What are some strategies I can use when meeting and talking with someone who is depressed?
So for me, I always come back to values. Like, how would you approach anyone? And I think that it can be really helpful to be patient, kind, understanding. And those are values I try to use. I don't know what values everyone else wants to use when they meet people in their lives. But yeah, those are values that I think can be really helpful. And just to be really understanding that it may be a slow, long-term process. And to also check in around if they're wanting support as well. I went to a training recently, and like one of the most profound things I got from this three-day training was, if you look for a problem, you're going to find a problem. But if you also look for someone's strengths and what they are able to do, you'll also find those. And I think it really helps the way that you will see a person. If you see them as broken or this is a problem, chances are you'll find stuff that confirms that. But also if you see someone who's trying to do their best or has got strengths, you'll probably find that as well.
Should I move on, or
I can answer a few. I guess even though depression has sort of certain things that are going to be the same with people, everyone's experience is different. So I don't want to be too specific. I think I can just answer from my experience. But the things that were hard about when people would spend time with me were if I felt like they were at really high expectations of the things I'd be able to do. So putting pressure on me or high expectations or like, let's hang out, but let's meet in this really busy place in the middle of the day and then let's go here and let's go here. was just kind of stressful to even think about. But so things that were kind of low-key, low-pressure, but people letting me know they wanted to spend time with me. They didn't mind if I wasn't feeling great. They didn't mind if I hadn't washed my hair in a week. But they just wanted to be with me and wanted to do something that was kind of doable for me, that was really affirming for me. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, and we're gonna look at this topic a little bit more in 2 weeks' time. David's gonna be taking the message in a couple of weeks' time, and it's gonna be particularly around what's it around again, David? Around distress. How do we respond when people are in mental distress? Is that right?
Yeah, just some basic skills from Lifeline that I think could be helpful. You guys probably already know everything I'm going to talk about, but I just like to talk about it anyway. It's just my little feel like I'm doing something kind of, yeah, that's me.
It'll be great. I've seen the notes. It's really good. Okay, here's another question. How does historical trauma affect the nervous system or affect our mental health and well-being? Historical trauma.
So I didn't know whether this was personal historical trauma or whether this was like generational trauma.
Good question. Maybe it could be either. Yeah.
Either or both?
Yeah.
You want to answer it first?
So this might be a little bit long-winded, so I apologize. So I think in terms of the history of trauma, that there were significant findings like after the World Wars. They found that a lot of servicemen came back and were experiencing flashbacks and found it really hard to reintegrate into society. And as research has progressed, they've found that that trauma does lodge itself in the brain and in the body. And in terms of a personal experience of this, like we were doing a project for a university, and I was reflecting on when I went to intermediate. And for me, intermediate wasn't a fun time. And I can remember also going to intermediate that I'd often have ham sandwiches, like shaved ham sandwiches. So it's really funny, even now, whenever I like see shaved ham, I start to feel nauseous in my body. It's okay. But I'll eat ham off the bone instead. It's really weird. But I start to feel nauseous around that shaved ham because of all those tough times I had in intermediate. And I also recently I was hanging out with a friend, and that friend is a New Zealand born person of Chinese heritage, and a small kid went past and they like racially abused them and said some comment, and my friend had like a really, 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 really strong reaction to that. So I don't think it even necessarily has to be big traumas like a war that can let trauma can start getting stored in the body. It can be even those little microaggressions that like a lot of minority populations experience that starts to store itself in the body and may come out in a disproportionate response or in a response like feeling nauseous towards a certain food, or when you meet a certain person you might feel really uncomfortable, and there mightn't even be anything wrong with that person, but that person may remind you of someone that's maybe hurt you in the past, something like that. And it's just those little things the body will kind of try and keep itself safe from those threatening situations, even if that's not a threatening situation.
I don't know if you've all seen, but there's I've forgotten this guy's name, that's really unhelpful, who's done a demonstration of the way the brain's structured by using a fist. So I'll just talk about it real quick because it's sort of helpful. So if you think, so your arm is sort of like your spine, and then you get to sort of your brain stem, which is where your brain kind of attaches to your spine. And then if you think about the way the brain is structured, the thumb and the bottom is what we call the sort of animal brain, or your basic brain. So this is like all survival instincts bits here. So, if you guys heard of fight, flight, or freeze. So if you're in some sort of crisis, emergency, you react sort of not at an animal level, but just at a very basic survival level. So you might fight to survive. You might run away to survive. Or sometimes people might freeze, you panic. And so we call that sort of the animal part of the brain. And then over the top of that is sort of your the way that you can control things. So like your logic and your reasoning and your ability to think and to control yourself. And so kind of, they've all got fancy names, but I won't bother. And so this is your brain. And what happens with trauma, or if you get really distressed, is they call it, you flip off. You lose the ability to kind of think properly and logically and process. And you're just reacting with this part of your brain, which is just trying to survive. And so that happens if you kind of are panicking. This happens if you're in a really stressful situation. And sometimes your brain gets sensitized. If something really bad happens to you, stuff will trigger that, and that's how you're going to respond. You see it quite often in children as well, like, you know, suddenly I can't find any words, and I'm just reacting and feeling things, and I don't know how to process it. So part of helping people with trauma is figuring out how to bring the fingers back down till they can sort of be calmer and think clearly again and figure out how to get what they need.
So again, we hear of this integratedness of our well-being as well, don't we? Around how this physical trauma stuff can affect us in our minds, emotions, in all sorts of different ways, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as Laura was alluding to before, like, I think some of this trauma can also be intergenerational. Like, my feeling at the moment with what's happening in New Zealand is that there may be there's a lot of responses to, I guess, the repairing of, like, what's happened in the past. And I feel like there are probably a lot of people who have, like, their parents or grandparents were maybe colonised, or they've had certain experiences, and that stuff can, I believe, be passed down inadvertently sometimes.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Okay, here's a curly one. So I'm conscious of time, but this is good stuff, isn't it, guys? Yes. Okay, so here's the question. Surely Satan is working against our good mental health and right way of thinking. When in modern medicine is the real problem demonic? And how should Christians view demonic possession versus mental health?
So I might let you speak to the demonic possession side of things. This is sort of the curly question that it's sort of difficult to answer. I'm not an expert in satanic demonic possession stuff. I was thinking about, when the Bible was written, we knew much less about a whole lot of stuff. And when people don't understand why things happen, they can try and explain them by talking about forces outside themselves. I read this book about this family in a cult, and a young boy had diabetes. He's 5. And the church refused to let them go and get a doctor and get modern medicine because they thought that it was a test of faith, and that if they prayed hard enough and believed, that the child would be healed. And we know that diabetes is a very serious illness that requires medicine, and he ended up dying. So I think similarly to physical illness, mental illness, I would always say prayer is really important. Prayer is needed. Let's always pray for people, but let's not be afraid to seek help in other places as well. Yeah. That didn't answer the question at all.
David, you got some thoughts on this?
Yeah, I in terms of the history of psychology, what happened was, again, in the 1950s, I think it was in France, there was a big conflict went on between the church and the government because they started to break away from the notion that mental illness was demonic possession, and that it was more maybe people's experiences, maybe their genetics. And I feel like psychology as a field is constantly developing. Like, we may be giving you some answers today, but like, I also know that it's a field that is constantly refining itself, it's questioning itself. So the way we practice today, I wouldn't be surprised in 20 years if there's even a different way that we practice that's more helpful for people. And that, hopefully that doesn't make you feel like, well, maybe what they're talking about is unhelpful. But we're constantly trying to refine and to question what's going on for people. And, yeah, that's what I'll say about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, if people have long-lasting sadness in their life, for example, you know, not just momentarily or, you know, not, I'm not talking about grief, but just, you know, a bit more involved than that, that doesn't mean that Satan, whatever that means, is in control of our lives. As we've talked about, everybody has mental health, like physical health. Sometimes our mental health is affected by trauma, by stress from the environments that we live and work in, from the ever-increasing speed of life that life is lived at, and from the increasing demands and expectations, you know, for example, around instant communications and gratification. And genetics probably play a part in it too. And so there's lots of factors that affect our mental well-being, not an evil spirit somehow entering our body and taking control of us. That's, yeah, I'm going to leave that there as well. Okay, how can we include people and help them feel important and not ignored when they might not be able to do this for themselves for whatever reason, such as social anxiety?
I always think if you're feeling outside of your depth when supporting someone, that may be a sign that they need to get other support. So if you ever feel like someone is like you're worried about their safety or you're concerned about them, like getting them to contact a line like 1737, which can be done on the phone or text, can be a really helpful first step for them just to connect with someone to check about what's going on. But I think, again, it comes back to being really patient and understanding. And I think especially those people that probably go through social anxiety and may say no to a lot of events or like to keep to themselves or do things a little bit differently, that's just trying to be patient and understanding. And I think I know it can be really frustrating if you're really wanting to connect with someone and it seems like they're putting all these barriers to you, like helping them, but just also trusting in their abilities as well. Yeah, and also like for people who have people with chronic mental health challenges in their lives, just being mindful of your own self-care as well. Like just knowing when you need to step back and maybe take care of yourself for a bit as well. Because I really take my hat off to all those people who are supporting those with chronic mental health challenges.
Yes, everything he said. And I think if we want to be friends with people who, say, have social anxiety, it's really natural to want to invite them to places and get them to meet people because we're like, oh, the church is great, everyone will be really friendly, and you all are. But sometimes that feels like a big deal for someone, even if they're probably going to, you know, enjoy it eventually. So I think sometimes, you know, it's just meeting people where they're at. If they're too scared to hang out in a big group, try and invite them to something where it's a small group. Just invite them out for coffee with two people. I think sometimes we're very well-intentioned, but we put pressure on people to sort of join in with us instead of trying to meet them where they're at. And it's also helpful to find out exactly what about things makes people anxious so you can try and sort of minimise that.
Great. I think we'll wrap things up there, eh? But we talked about mentioned about that text number that we can call, and I think next week we'll probably put out a list of resources and places people can go to for support. But I'm just wondering now if you could recommend any practices to us that are helpful when we are feeling frazzled, or even if we're not.
I prepared a small exercise, and I don't know if we're all going to say it out loud or how it's going to go, but all you need to remember is five. We've got five senses, and it goes 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So if you're ever having any overwhelming thoughts or feelings, it can be really helpful just to shift your focus to what's going on outside of you. So what I need everyone to do, if you're ready, is to look around the room and list five things you can see. And then listen for four things you can hear. Listen carefully. Now think of three things you can feel externally. Might be your socks and your shoes, or the feeling of the chair. And then two things you can smell. Hope it's not me. Sorry.
I was going to say it.
And then one thing you can taste, even if it's just noticing saliva on your tongue. So that's just a small little grounding exercise that you can take anywhere. And all you've got to remember is 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So 5 things I can see, 4 things I can hear, 3 things I can feel, 2 things I can smell, and 1 thing I can taste.
Great. And that's, yeah, a really helpful thing when our minds are all over the place to ground us back in the here and now, to be fully present with whatever, with however we need to be in the here and now. Hey, thanks so much, Laura and David. We really appreciate you guys and the skill and the insight and the vulnerability that you've shared this morning. Let's give them a big hand, eh? Thanks.